Hello and welcome in.
First Science Mixtape.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Well, good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay, and welcome to the first Saturday of 2017. A very happy new year to you all. Now, one thing we're asking on the show today is, have you made any New Year's resolutions? And if so, what are they? Please, please send them in. You can tweet us at Soho Radio or at Science Mixtape because we would love to know. The reason why we want to know is because a lot of New Year's resolutions tend to be lifestyle changes. You exercise more, you're going to sleep more, you're going to drink less, you're going to give up smoking. I think you all know what I mean, like changes to your lifestyle. And what's really cool is that these lifestyle choices, together with our environment, can actually have permanent effects on our DNA and change the way our genes are expressed. We call these changes epigenetics. And joining me today to talk more about it is Maya Elliott, a nutritional geneticist at the University of Surrey, who specialises in the epigenetic effects of our diet and how it links to Alzheimer's. Good morning, Maya.
Hi, Matilda.
I should probably start by asking, what has your New Year's resolution been?
I'm planning to give up meat for an entire year.
Ooh.
Yeah, I did try to do it with alcohol, but then I saw on New Year's Day that I had a half a bottle of Rioja left. So that didn't last very long.
Well, being vegetarian is great as well.
Yeah, no, I don't really buy meat ever, so it's not going to be a massive lifestyle change for me. But I think also learning how to make sure that I get all the right nutrients without meat is kind of going to be my new project.
We also have a New Year's brain teaser for you all. I've made it Sherlock Holmes themed because obviously Sherlock Holmes has been the big thing to watch in the new year. So here we go. Sherlock Holmes was challenged to make a pre-drawn line smaller without erasing it. He did it in fractions of seconds. How? If you think you know, tweet us the answer. We'll be revealing it at the end of the show. Any ideas, Maya?
None at all.
Held it really far away.
Nope. Keep trying. Now, it's your mixtape, so what song are we kicking off with this morning?
I thought we'd start with something to motivate anyone who's trying to give up something in their life as a New Year's resolution. So I picked a power ballad, which is I Will Survive.
Walk out the door, just turn around now, 'cause you're not welcome anymore. Weren't you the one who tried to hurt me with goodbye? You think I'd crumble? You think I'd lay down and die? Oh, no, not I. I will survive. Oh, as long as I know how to love, I know I'll be alive. I've got all my life to live. I've got all my love to give. And I'll survive. I will survive. Hey, hey.
When a new human embryo is formed, roughly 99% of the epigenetic changes acquired during the lifetime of the parents are reprogrammed. This allows the cells of the developing embryo to create their own epigenome as they become all different types of cells in a fully grown organism.
Now, there's a lot of like quite complicated words in that, so I think we should unpack that fact because I think it's really cool and it really gets to the heart of what epigenetics is and what these changes are. So I mentioned at the beginning that there are changes that our environment can make to our genes. But like when I say changes, like what is actually changing and what is happening? What is that mechanism?
So epigenetics isn't actually changes to the DNA code, but it's changes to the DNA kind of around the DNA. So if you see your DNA as like a massive blueprint, then epigenetic changes would be the kind of post-its, like
stuck onto
it, being like, do this, do that. And it basically, they're chemical tags often that tell the cell which genes should be active and which ones should be inactive. There's three main mechanisms of epigenetic modifications. There's DNA methylation, which is, like I said, a chemical tag. Generally, it's associated with turning a gene off. There's histone modifications, which can kind of change the conformation of the DNA so it can like pack it up really tight.
Yeah, because the histone is like a protein that you wind the DNA around, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. And then there's something called microRNAs as well. And those basically just block the gene so that no proteins can access it and they can't be activated.
And they can't like read it and,
yeah.
and turn it into a thing. And so, yeah, going back to that first fact at the beginning, this is how we have different cells in our body, isn't it? This is why, you know, I've come from one egg that's been fertilized, one single cell, but I have hair cells and eye cells and nails and they are all different thing, different bits of my genetic code being activated in those different cells.
Yeah, it'd be really bad if you had some genes for your hand activated in your eye cells, that are hand specific anyway. So
it's really interesting that there's that they all have the same basic blueprint, that you could switch something really random off in a different organ.
Yeah, and it
like
does
the
happen.
Eye color for blue in your pancreas or something, like that's quite weird.
I mean, how would we know?
Yeah, so I think when I was younger, I understood that like this was how we had these markers on top, and that's why identical twins could have the same DNA but could look a bit different or have different personalities, and that was cool. What blows my mind is the kind of area that you're in, which is that actually the environment we live in day to day can be changing those markers day to day. And so it's not like you're born and you get your cells turned into the different cells as you develop, but actually all the time it's changing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we are only just understanding how big an impact our environment's having. My research is looking very much at how much of a trait is actually caused by your DNA and how much is caused by your environment and how much is caused by your environment affecting your DNA and your DNA in turn kind of affecting your internal environment.
Do you have
environment.
Any examples of that?
So one of my favourite kind of genes is called proxyn proliferator activator receptor gamma coactivator 1 alpha. It's a sexy gene.
It's and like the supercalifragilistics of genes.
Yeah, basically everything's called PPARGC something, so it's not much more difficult to learn the whole word. But this gene is actually activated by exercise, it's activated by caffeine, and it's activated by cold exposure. So
And what does it do when it's activated?
So it is involved in fat metabolism. So it gets your white fat and kind of converts it into brown fat. And brown fat is the fat that burns energy. So if you're looking to lose weight, you want this gene to be activated, really, which is why it's activated by exercise. But the coolest thing is that they found that people who sleep naked or with not a lot of clothes on in kind of like a slightly cooler temperature actually have way more of this gene activated, or this gene is way more activated in them over the course of the night, which means that maybe you could burn fat just by sleeping. And I love that.
Sleeping in the cold.
Yeah.
That is brilliant. And so when these changes happen, are they permanent or are they reversible or is it a mixture of both?
Well, it depends on the stage. During development, most of the epigenetic changes, they are kind of fixed.
Like you said, you don't want your eye cells turning into your hand.
Exactly. It's actually extremely important that those don't change. However, the things that we acquire, like the kind of epigenetic modifications that we acquire over the course of our day, those can actually happen extremely quickly. For example, just a short burst of exercise can activate like metabolic genes, or if we have something like consistent trauma over a number of months or years, this can actually also affect our genes in a more kind of our gene expression in a more long term, kind of setting. The reason why this is so important is because we're also looking at things like post-traumatic stress disorder. And it means that there's hope for people who have acquired these kind of epigenetic changes that hopefully with therapy and through understanding it better, we'll be able to reverse these conditions.
Mm-hmm. And the one example of epigenetics that really caught my imagination like quite a long time ago was this idea that it can be passed from one generation to the next, because I remember learning at school about natural selection, and it's, you know, you think, yes, that explains how we adapt over time, but it's quite a slow process. You've got to wait for quite a lot of people to die out for like most of the population to have the better trait. And then this epigenetics, it seems, if it can be passed on, explains maybe how we can see adaptations happening more quickly.
Absolutely. So this is why I think that is such a sexy field, because it's we can actually observe, how our environment is kind of sending a signal, how we are transmitting a kind of message through our DNA to the next generation already, being like, this is what the environment is like at the moment, and this is how you should adapt in order to survive. One example of this is the Dutch Hunger Winter of 1944.
Yes, this is like my favorite example ever.
Yeah, yeah. So actually, I'm half Dutch, and my grandmother was actually conceived during the Dutch Hunger Winter, which
Seriously?
Is why I got so interested in epigenetics. Yeah. She was conceived during the Dutch Hunger Winter, and this was a time when I think the Nazis, they'd kind of blocked nutritional or like food supplies off to the west of Holland.
Yeah.
And so adults were restricted to about 400 calories a day, and a lot of people starved.
Yeah, I've read things that people eating grass and like tulip bulbs and surviving on about 30% of their normal daily calories.
Yeah, it was, and it lasted for a year, but the effects are still evident today, 60 years later. So what they found was that in anyone who was kind of conceived during the hunger winter and was kind of in the first and second trimester when there was this food shortage.
So that's kind of the first 3 months or the 4 to 6 months.
Yeah. They found that these individuals had an increased expression or increased activity of this gene called insulin-like growth factor 2, which I'm just going to call IGF-2.
Mm-hmm.
Now, normally, in like a normal situation, we inherit one IGF-2 gene from our dad and one from our mum. And the one from our mum is always switched off by methylation. So that specific gene just gets loads and loads of methyl tags put on it so that the baby doesn't grow too big.
Because obviously that's actually, you can't have a baby that's so big it's going to kill the mum.
Exactly, exactly. And this is kind of a battle between the sexes that's going on, because we've when we're looking at imprinting, which is what this is called, when one parent's gene is always switched off and the other one is always switched on, it tends to be the dad's genes that are the ones that are always switched on and like kind of promoting the biggest baby that takes the most nutrients.
Male stereotypes, even in genetics.
Yeah. And then the mother's gene, the mother's
like
DNA.
The sensible one being like, don't kill me.
Yes,
I
exactly.
have to grow this thing.
I have to push it out of me. And also like the mother might have other children that it needs to supply with nutrients, might be breastfeeding. So that's why it's kind of funny that the mother's genes are always the ones that are switched off, are always the ones that are kind of making sure that the baby doesn't get too big. But they found that in the babies that were born just after the Dutch Hunger Winter or during, if they're in the first or second trimester, they would have less methylation on the mum's IGF-2 gene, which meant that they had more activity of both their mum's gene and, of course, their dad's gene was already
switched
on. So
they had more of the counter one saying, no, stay small.
No, actually, they had more of the one, it's a growth factor. So it would actually kind of help them to grow. But it's because there were such limited nutrients that if it was something that was limiting them from growing, then they wouldn't be able to be, like, developed at all by the time that they were pushed out.
So that's knowing that your environment doesn't have the, that's amazing.
Yes, so it means it needs to make the absolute most of every single nutrient that comes
that's
in,
amazing.
Which means that, it basically then means that the offspring's still viable even though it has less nutrition. Now, this is extremely useful if you're in a
starvation period.
Starvation period, absolutely. But the problem is that if that starvation period doesn't continue, then you have individuals who have excess amounts of excess activity in this IGF-2 growth gene. So these individuals, 60 years later, are now much, much more likely to have problems with diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease. And the reason they, they think that is just because they have this methylation change that occurred when they were in the womb hasn't been switched back. Right.
That's incredible. The diet of your mum has affected how you then process food and how you like retain weight and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not just your mum either. So the egg that you came from was made in the womb of your maternal grandmother.
That's true.
Yeah, because women are typically born with all their egg cells. So, so the egg that I came from was made in my grandmother's womb. So her diet will also have affected the kind of epigenetic changes. And usually, you said earlier that 99% of, or was it 99?
Yeah, 99%.
Yeah, 99% of epigenetic changes are kind of rebooted and you start with a blank slate. But it's not true, because actually from the 1% that does survive, we tend to find that those are the ones that are kind of transmitting a extreme change in environment. Mm.
And then, of course, you get a whole bunch more from the uterine environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, on to song two. What are we having next?
Well, in a somewhat distasteful, I thought we'd go with Starving.
It's by Hallie Steinfeld.
You know just what to say. Things that scare me, I should just walk away. But I can't move my feet. The more that I know you, the more I want to. Something inside me's changed. I was so much younger yesterday. Oh. I didn't know that I was starving till I tasted you. Don't need no butterflies when you give me the whole damn zoo. By the way, you do things to my body. I didn't know that I was starving till I tasted you.
In a recent study of yeast cells, which have many similar properties to our own, 90% of the genes were affected by changes in the nutrients that the cell had access to. This suggests that almost all of our genes will be influenced by the food that we eat.
And this, I believe, is what our whole next section is about. So Maya, you've brought some food in with you today.
I have.
And you're going to be telling us the epigenetic changes that this meal could be creating.
This is very fitting for New Year's.
Yeah, anyone on diet, like, we're going to get some top tips about good foods to eat.
I have a slight confession. Not all of it is epigenetic. Some of it is just how I'm going to justify eating all of this.
Right. That's fine.
Genetics or science in general.
So should we first, could you just list what we've got in our feast before us?
Yeah, so I know today is Saturday, but tomorrow it's Sunday, and a lot of people, I imagine, will be having a Sunday roast. So I got kind of the staple ingredients for a roast dinner. You've got roast chicken, the potatoes, broccoli. We've got kind of like a leafy salad, if anyone's really into that. Some tomatoes. And depending on whether you are doing this like sober thing for a New Year's resolution. Dry January, that's it. I've got a full fat Coke or a red wine. So all of these things I can justify with science for you. So you don't have to feel guilty about it tomorrow.
Okay.
I should point out at this point that I'm not a nutritionist. I am by background a geneticist, so
that's good enough.
Yeah,
that's good enough for me.
Okay, so let's tuck straight in. I'm gonna pick food. I'm gonna have a bite, and then while I'm eating it, I want you to tell me all about it. I'm gonna jump straight in and have a piece of this broccoli tree.
Okay. So broccoli contains a chemical called sulforaphane. And sulforaphane has been shown to kind of increase the expression of cell cycle genes. Now, cell cycle genes are incredibly important for our health because they prevent cells from replicating too quickly or with any kind of mutations in them that haven't been yet corrected. So one of the causes of cancer is the fact that your cell might have a mutation in it just from like replication. That's completely normal. But those mutations need to be corrected before they are kind of
get out of control.
So we have these cell cycle genes that will slow down the kind of whole cell cycle so that the cell can be checked. And this is actually one of the genes that sulforaphane will activate. And it's found in broccoli, and they've actually started trials recommending it to people who have prostate cancer or breast cancer.
Seriously? So it's almost like I'm eating an anti-cancer thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And
hello, broccoli.
Yeah, it's...
this is why you should eat your greens, children.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing is that it's also just incredibly delicious, and you don't need to eat an awful lot of it in order to get the benefits of it. So they recommend like a small cup of broccoli per day could actually have... kind of cancer preventative effects.
That's so cool. Iman, what food would you like to eat?
I would like to go for some cherry tomatoes.
So cherry tomatoes, or just tomatoes in general, they contain something called lycopene. And I absolutely love tomatoes, especially
Me
when
too.
I'm on holiday. Yeah, because I am very, very pale. I am like see-through my skin. And so I burn really, really quickly. But lycopene actually increases the expression of melanin. And melanin is a pigment in our skin that gives us a lovely tan. Mm. But it also, having that tan protects
It's protective
our,
against the UV radiation,
it
isn't
does,
it?
It yeah. does, yeah. And so that's why...
darker skinned people don't burn as easily.
Exactly. And they are less likely to get things like skin cancer from just normal exposure. So as someone who has extremely light skin, I don't have a lot of melanin. So I am probably at higher risk. I have a kind of history in the family of skin cancer as well. So when I go on holiday, I stock up on tomatoes. And the best fact about it is that you will release more lycopene if you cook the tomatoes first in oil.
Really?
Yeah. So I didn't know this, but... I was absolutely delighted when I found out, because it means that bolognese is like, you're basically fighting skin cancer.
Absolutely. Add the delicious oil and it's even better.
Yeah, exactly. So no guilt there.
All right. What are you going to be eating, Maya?
Well, seeing as I'm now going vegetarian for New Year, I guess I'm going to have to go for the potatoes.
They're delicious.
I do have an awesome fact about potatoes for you. It's just not epigenetic. So because I'm now working in a nutrition department and everyone there is pretty much nutritionist, I'm picking up some pretty cool kind of tips and facts. And one of them I learned recently is that potatoes are very, very high in starch. But if you cook the potato or pasta or anything like that and then eat it directly, your body can absorb most of that starch.
Mm-hmm.
And the response is that you get a very high glycemic response, which means there's a lot of sugar in your blood.
Because you're breaking the starch down into the sugar.
Exactly. Now, this can actually increase your risk of things like diabetes, insulin resistance, all these. And in turn, I mean, if you don't use that sugar, if you don't burn that sugar, then it'll go into fat.
Yeah.
However, a recent study has shown that if you were to cool down your potatoes or your pasta directly after making it and then reheat it later once it's cooled down, a lot of that starch has then become indigestible, which means that you can't absorb it and you can't break it down
into the sugars.
So you could eat an entire bowl of pasta or roast potatoes that have been cooled down and then reheated, and you wouldn't get the same glycemic response. You would be reducing your risk of diabetes, and most of the starch would just pass through you. So,
oh my God, I love it. I eat leftovers all the time anyway.
Exactly.
Okay, I am on dry January, so I'm going to have some of this Coke.
Okay. Excellent. So Coke contains a lot of caffeine, right?
Mm.
And caffeine, as I mentioned earlier, has been shown to activate some of the same metabolic genes as exercise.
Great, so I could just sit here drinking my Coke.
Yes, so you could go for a jog after having your Sunday roast, or you could have a cup of coffee or a Diet, or no, not a Diet Coke, a regular Coke, because we were talking about that glycemic response a second ago, and actually Diet Coke, even though it doesn't contain any sugar, the sweeteners in it will kind of produce a greater glycemic response. So you'll actually produce more insulin because your body's like, oh, what is this?
We need to get rid of it, metabolize it.
Exactly. But it can't. Mm. So that actually increases your risk of, I think, diabetes.
Type 2 diabetes. Yeah, the one that you get from not responding to your body's insulin anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's how I would justify a full fat Coke.
Basically, I have all the excuses I need until next January.
Yeah,
this is great.
This is how I get away with being a terrible hypocrite.
Okay.
So you'll be having the wine.
Yes.
We all want justification for wine.
We do all want justification for wine. And
eagerly waiting.
Yeah, the study that I'm going to refer to, it was done about 5 or 7 years ago. But they did a study looking at memory and kind of alcohol consumption. And they found that women who drink 1 to 2 glasses per day actually had improved memory compared to women who didn't drink any, or women who drank more than that. And I didn't look too deep into the study because I didn't want to.
I don't want to find any flaws.
No,
in the study.
I'm just going to hold on to that. And they think it's because of acetylcholine being released into the brain as a byproduct of alcohol metabolism, and they think that that might actually have a beneficial effect. So, also red wine's full of antioxidants. So
yeah,
you know, can't really go wrong there.
This does just show like how difficult working in nutrition must be, because yes, Coke does have caffeine in it, and that will activate the same gene that's activated by exercise, and that's great, but it also has a ton of sugar and other stuff, which is not going to be very good for me. Do you ever find that really frustrating, where it's like, you know, there's so much stuff that you've got to kind of balance and weigh and work out the proportions, and loads of conflicting evidence? I mean,
nutrition is such a difficult field to work in. I mean, coming from a kind of cancer genetics background before, I have so much respect for all the nutritionists, because there is so much evidence, and also people seem to respond to it differently. What works for one person just doesn't work for another person. What elicits one response in someone will have a completely different response if the situation is just a tiny bit different. It can be something like the time of day. So it's so incredibly complex. And I mean, the easy stuff is the stuff that I do, which is controlled by genes, because we can like kind of figure that out. But the other stuff, the kind of environmental impact that actually just doesn't go through genetic mechanisms.
All the different reactions that just the food is going through.
Yeah, I find that so incredibly complex, and I have a lot of respect for anyone who works in the field of nutrition. The other, I guess, big challenge is the fact that we all feed ourselves, we all kind of have our own opinions about it, but we don't actually know an awful lot about how our biology, like how we work, like. And I mean, I've studied it, and I still feel completely ignorant. But it's one thing to listen to your body and take on the advice of experts, but it's another thing to just follow the, like, you can also just follow the advice of experts and not listen to your body, and that is also terrible. So it's just trying to find a really good balance of, you know,
especially because if you only saw the thing that was like, Coke is good, it's like exercise, and you didn't see all the bad stuff, but like, you might just get one-sided information, and then you're doing
exactly this is exactly
thing.
What I'm doing right now, by the way, when I say that, you know, I'm justifying Coke. I do know that
it's all in good jest.
I'm just
but it's also an excellent example of how complicated the field can
You can cherry pick, you really can, and
the body, like that fact about the yeast shows, like if everything is being so responsive to the environment and changing, and all our food is affecting all of our genes and everything, then you, like, it must be so hard to do proper experiments, because the body's just going to keep changing. Whatever you do, it's just going to keep changing in response.
Yeah, and so as the reason why epigenetics research is so exciting at the moment is because these technologies are advancing, and we're now able to map a person's, like, all the chemical tags on a person's DNA for the first time ever. And so this is the kind of stuff that I study. How does it differ between twins, and why? But I think as we get more experienced in this, we're going to be able to see a lot more short-term effects, and hopefully that'll speed the whole process up, and maybe even one day we can look at it ourselves. That's my dream, that I could just kind of on a week-to-week basis monitor how my gene expression is, to kind of see whether this health kick I'm doing is actually doing me any good.
I'm going to stop you there because we have to get in your third song, but I definitely want to come back to this. So what is your third song?
My third song is Chronic by Phoebe Ryan, because this is how I feel about cheese.
Sweet relief, 'cause I like doing what I like. Constantly, I suffer from my sorry lives. It's killing me, 'cause I know you love me right.
In 2011, scientists in Norway discovered that the best recipe to limit your risk of most lifestyle-related diseases is a third fat, a third protein, and a third carbohydrates.
And that sounds like sensible advice and all the stuff we've known before. Like, don't cut out food group, keep it all the same.
Yeah, I mean, different people will need slightly different things based on what their lifestyle is, of course. But yeah, generally, that's a good rule of thumb, I think.
Now, I want to come on to what your research really focuses on, and that's the link between your diet and Alzheimer's.
Yes.
Tell me more about that.
Well, we've seen a kind of massive increase in the incidence of Alzheimer's, especially with kind of our growing and aging population. And it's really, really scary because we don't actually understand that well how the brain works.
No.
So I think there's a real mentality that, you know, we just need to find a cure and then it'll be fine. But we are becoming increasingly aware that actually prevention is a much, much safer a way of preventing this epidemic from really becoming a massive burden on our society. Mm. So, one of the ways that we think that we might be able to kind of ameliorate our risk of Alzheimer's is through our diet. And now that we've got kind of technological advances that are allowing us to detect very small fluctuations in nutritional status, we've noticed that actually quite a big portion of the elderly population are in fact vitamin B12 deficient.
Vitamin B12, that's the one you get from meat, isn't it?
Yeah, so you get it from meat, you get it from dairy. We can't make it ourselves, or we do have bacteria make it, and we do have some of those bacteria, but they're kind of too far down our digestive tract for us to be able to absorb it.
Uh-huh.
But other animals that either eat their own feces or have like an extra stomach, they can get B12 from their own gut microbes.
Right.
So if we eat their animal products, so like meat, dairy, eggs, then we can, that's a really great way for us to get vitamin B12.
And why do they think that being B12 deficient might cause, is it simply just a correlation we've seen, like people with Alzheimer's tend to be B12 deficient, or do we think there's a mechanism?
We think there's a mechanism. I mean, so in cases of extreme B12 deficiency, and when I'm talking about a large portion of our elderly population are B12 deficient, I mean like mildly deficient, but in people who are extremely deficient, such as people with pernicious anemia, we've long associated that with kind of cognitive diseases. So that's kind of where the first link was made. It's like, these people are completely deficient in B12 and they have a very, very high risk of cognitive disease. We've done a lot of research into it, the kind of mechanisms, and we think it might have something to do with myelin. Myelin is the kind of protective coating.
The fatty sheath around your nerves.
Exactly, around your nerves. B12 is really important for making sure that this sheath remains intact.
Which, for anyone who hasn't heard of it before, it's really important for making sure we conduct our nervous impulses.
Yes.
And they travel from A to B efficiently and fast.
Yes, exactly. So if you have too little B12, then this myelin sheath, the integrity of it kind of declines, and so you can't conduct the impulses as well. So that's one way. But the difficulty that we're facing, and this is with any kind of nutritional research, is that they have done intervention studies looking at B12 in like elderly people who are at risk of Alzheimer's, and only a fraction of those people will benefit from getting the treatment.
From getting the B12 supplement.
Yeah.
At risk in like a hereditary point of view.
No, it's actually, so these people have shown kind of the first signs, and we call that mild cognitive impairment. So the first signs of accelerated cognitive decline, if you like. And so when they then gave all of these people vitamin B vitamin supplements, they found that the results were kind of conflicting. It worked in some people, didn't work in others. But people who had a very high level of a blood biomarker called homocysteine actually were the ones who benefited the most, and it could slow their cognitive decline. And so it does go to show that we need to take maybe a more personal approach to this as well. Just because something doesn't work for everyone doesn't mean it doesn't work for
it's just about
won't work for a lot of people.
Unpicking it even further.
Yeah.
Wow. And are there other things, other lifestyle things you can do to modify your risk of Alzheimer's?
Absolutely. Sleep is a huge factor. This is one of my other New Year's resolutions, is that I'm going to try and sleep 7 hours a night.
Join the vape.
Yeah, it's proving a little bit difficult sometimes. But sleep is so incredibly important. When we sleep, there's a really cool study that was done in mice that showed that their spinal fluid, when we're awake, actually, our spinal fluid is kept separate from kind of the fluid in our brain or in our like skull. And by like just a single layer of cells. And then the moment that we become unconscious, or that those mice become unconscious, the space between these cells opens by about 60%, which allows the spinal fluid to flow up into like the kind of a brain area and wash away any of the like...
I have heard about this, the washing that happens when we sleep, and they think it's washing waste products from our brain.
Yes.
And that like might be one of the reasons why we need to sleep.
Absolutely.
And why it's so beneficial. And
yeah, it might also be one of the reasons why we feel so groggy.
Yeah, and like awful, and you can't remember things. It's because like your brain is just full of waste products.
Yeah, but also, yeah, we feel so groggy when we like suddenly wake up. Maybe it's because there's all this extra fluid in our brain. That's what I think. But I do think it is like very, very relevant, because Alzheimer's is caused by beta amyloid plaques on the brain, and it's basically just a byproduct of brain metabolism. But if it isn't washed away, then beta amyloid does form these like plaques on the brain, and this is actually the key cause of Alzheimer's.
Is that why you're choosing to sleep more?
Absolutely. So one of the biggest revelations of 2016 for me was the fact that I actually have a predisposition to Alzheimer's in my DNA. And this is called the APOE4 gene. It's the gene that prevents you from kind of, it means that you have more beta amyloid in your brain, if you like.
Like to start with.
To start with. So that's why sleep is like also so important for me, because I need to make sure that it's kind of taken out efficiently. But the good thing is, I'm in the right field. I got my DNA sequence. That's kind of how I found out about it. And when I told people I was going to do this, they were all like, no, what are you doing?
Yeah,
like,
I think you don't that's how know. I feel about it. I mean, I was talking to myself before the show that I'd really like to have my DNA sequence from a kind of ethnicity point of view, and finding out like kind of where my ancestors came from. But from a kind of disease, kind of what's going to happen to me kind of view, I don't think I'd want to know.
Yeah, it is a bit scary.
Yeah, so like, did you do it because you had relatives and you thought you might have a hereditary risk that had Alzheimer's, or was it like an intrigue thing? Like why did you choose to do it?
I chose to do it because I figured that if I'm going to be telling people or kind of advising people to change their lifestyle based on what their own kind of predispositions are and what their own risks are, then I should probably put my money where my mouth is and just like do the test myself. I mean, even my supervisor, who's a geneticist himself, was like, wow, you like, are you sure you want to do that?
No, that is kind of amazing. You're right. If you're asking other people to do it, then yeah, you can then empathize with all the feelings they're going to feel around it.
And I didn't expect it. We don't, I don't know anyone in my family who's had Alzheimer's. So I wasn't expecting it, but I think it's really kind of, it's empowered me in a way because I know that I can reduce my risk of Alzheimer's.
Taking sort of preventative steps.
Yeah, by taking preventative steps, I can reduce my risk of Alzheimer's to that of someone who doesn't have a genetic predisposition. And so for me, like just knowing that I have like made some changes, I'm sleeping way more than I used to, because I used to sleep about 5 hours a night.
Oh my God.
I know. I wow. don't know how. And I'm started learning another language, because also that reduces your risk of Alzheimer's. And these are all things that I know I don't need to be worried about it now, but I figure if I kind of get into a healthy habit now, then I will benefit from it later, definitely.
How did you feel when you first like realised that you'd got it or got that increased risk?
I'm not gonna lie, I was very kind of concerned, not just for myself, but I was also thinking like, who did I get it from? Which of my parents, you know? And I both like, I was open with them, but they both didn't really want to know if it was them. And that's just a personal thing, I guess. I had to be quite sensitive about it when telling the rest of my family, because not everyone wants to know. But I felt like it was very empowering because I felt like I'm kind of in control, whereas I mean, I don't want to be 70 years old and regret a lot of things I did when I was younger, because I know
if only I'd known.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's such a tricky one. Like, I was having this conversation with my boyfriend and he was saying, would you do it? And I was like, I don't know. I think if it was offered to me, I would, but I wouldn't chase it down because I have no reason to need to know that I'm aware of at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason I can really think of is that probably about a third of the population have this increased risk. And it doesn't mean that we're all going to get Alzheimer's. Risk does not mean that you are like predetermined, like that you are going to get it. It means that you, if you don't do anything, that is what your risk is. Yeah. If you do something, you can lower your risk. So it's I thought it was very empowering anyway.
Yeah, and I think like kind of brave and amazing that you did it.
Thanks.
What is your fourth song?
So I picked my fourth song thinking this is a little bit how I feel about getting my DNA sequenced, and just kind of that empowering moment.
And it's Unwritten by Natasha Bedingfield.
Bees and the fertile queen isn't their genetics but their diet. Larvae designed to become queens are fed exclusively with royal jelly, a substance secreted by worker bees which switches on the gene program that results in the bee becoming fertile.
News just in. Brixton Road in South London breaches its annual air population limit in the first 5 days.
Lack of sleep may set the stage for Alzheimer's.
Living near heavy traffic increases risk of dementia.
A giant 5,000 square kilometre iceberg is poised to break away from Antarctica. That's equivalent in size to the state of Delaware.
Burning more fat, less glucose could lead to diabetes.
The part of the brain that recognises faces has been shown to grow way into adulthood.
So, I just thought this was hilarious that within 5 days, Brixton Road in South London has already got rid of its pollution limits. So this is an EU law about how much nitrous oxide there's allowed to be in the air, and it's supposed to be only 200 micrograms per cubic metre, and Brixton Road has already exceeded this about 17 times.
Oh my gosh. Why? Like how?
Just from having lots of diesel kind of buses and cars and then loads of buildings around it that are keeping all of those gases in there. And this is having sort of high levels of this in the air has been linked to sort of 5,900 deaths a year or early deaths.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's not good. Tell me more about your story, Aman.
So kind of piggybacking on yours, a headline we see was talking about how living near heavy traffic increases your risk of dementia. And it's really fitting with what we were just talking about, Alzheimer's and everything like that. So some scientists did a kind of decade long study looking at about 6.6 million people living in Canada, Ontario. And 1 in 10 of those people went on to develop Alzheimer's or kind of early stage dementia, and this was thought to be attributed to living in a kind of built up area with sort of loads of heavy traffic. And the reason they think this is so is it's been speculated that pollution and heavy traffic reduces the density of white matter in the brain, so this is the kind of connective tissue, and then thus kind of lowers cognitive ability and things like that. So what scientists are now suggesting is that the magnetic kind of nanoparticles in pollution are somehow making their way into the brain and having this really kind of detrimental effect to people living there.
I'm a cyclist, so
me too.
Yeah, it's that's really scary.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to think that no matter how much technology advances or something, is kind of always some way disease and all that stuff will kind of catch up with us.
Exercise is going to be like good for keeping your brain healthy, but then if you're exercising on this busy road, maybe not so healthy.
That's why it's so complex.
And sorry, just to add that the risk kind of dropped off when you kind of got outside the immediate area, there was less built up, so there's definitely kind of strong evidence to suggest
we should all go live in suburbia. Tell me more about your losing weight responsibly in 2017.
So this is a really cool epigenetic study that was done recently. One of the chemical tags that is on our DNA, the one that everyone, or that is the most studied anyway, is called methylation, which turns genes off. But there's also such a thing as acetylation, which is generally associated with turning genes on. Mm-hmm. And it's just a different kind of chemical tag. And they actually found that when we're feeding, or when in this mouse study, when these mice were feeding, there was this protein that removes these kind of on switches on the DNA, removes them, which turns the metabolic genes off that are involved in burning fat. So at times when you're feeding...
So you get worse at burning fat.
Yeah, at the times when you're feeding, you use more glucose, which is, you know, easily taking up into the brain. And that means that when we're feeding, this is not probably the best time to burn fat, because this kind, it's kind of like a biological clock. Because as soon as we start to go into kind of like sleep mode, this gene called histone deacetylase 3 is actually turned off, which means that during the night we tend to burn more fat.
I suppose because we're not eating, and because so we need to keep our brain active, because our brain can only use sugar.
Exactly. So they advise, like based on this, I mean, this hasn't been done in humans yet, but based on the outcomes of this mouse study, that if you want to kind of trim any kind of excess weight that you've put on over Christmas, that it might be better to do light exercise in the evening instead of trying to burn your fat during the day. And the other thing that they also said is just fasting during the night. So not eating all throughout the night, because that will keep your... that will like kind of keep your fat burning genes off for longer. So yeah, 12 to 12 hours for men, I think, is actually something that's really beneficial for your health. So not eating between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m.
I think there are like diet books that recommend that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, absolutely.
Only and, eating in a 12-hour period between breakfast and dinner or something.
Yeah, I do it as well. And I think for me, it's made a huge difference because I used to struggle a lot with like fluctuating weight, and now it's very, very constant. So yeah, I definitely recommend anyone who wants to lose weight to do it responsibly, by, yeah, maybe exercising a little bit in the evening and, not
eating late.
Eating late. Yeah.
That's great. On to song five. This is Run For Your Life by Mako. And why have you chosen this one?
This is my new, kind of motivational running song, because I really think running is torture.
This is what we should all be listening to as we exercise lightly in the evening.
You got some brand new sneakers. Little darling, lace up, darling, lace up and make it fast. They'll try to make you talk, don't get nothing. Ear up against the wall, waiting for judgment. Open your prison door, nobody's watching. Ooh, ooh, ooh. You only get one shot, you better run for your life.
We've got to run for our lives too, as our time is very much running out. But just before we go, I just really quickly want to ask you if you think, you said we're starting to map the epigenome, and do you think this is the kind of medicine of the future, moving towards people having their genome and then epigenome sequenced and then everything being tailored?
Absolutely. I think if you understand kind of what your own limitations are, then we can really personalize medicine. For example, when I had my genome sequence, I learned that I am only able to metabolize folate 60% of what I should be able to. So I know, you know, later, folate is one of the methyl donors, by the way. So
helps with that chemical tagging.
Helps with the chemical tagging.
And you get it from leafy green vegetables, right?
Yes, that's correct. So I know that, you know, I should probably have a bit more leafy green vegetables in my diet. When I'm older, maybe I should take a supplement. But you also learn things like, how do you metabolize drugs? Medication. And I think that that's really beneficial, of course. If you want to live healthy for longer, you need to know what your body is good at and what your body needs help with. And it is a bit scary.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of huge trend for personalized medicine. And like Matilda and I were talking about the blood group diet and kind of...
Which I'd like to say I don't believe in, and I think it's rubbish.
Kind of very quickly dismissed. But it's kind of, it's something we want.
It's that idea that's been there for ages. Although, so I do think there's also a sense of it could go very Black Mirror. I could totally see a Black Mirror episode where everyone has their, like, this is what I'm allowed to eat, this is what I'm not allowed to eat, I must sleep this much and I must exercise this much, and it's almost prescriptive, and you start to live in fear of doing it wrong, and if you do it wrong, then you're going to increase your risk of things, and then it's your fault if you get ill, rather than it just being like back in the day when it was, you know, a curse from God or something. And I don't know how to, if there is like a more happy medium of like, maybe only your doctor can see your genome and then they know what to tell you about it, or...
I'm very biased, of course, because as a geneticist, I want to know everything, not just about myself, but also my boyfriend or my family or whatever, you know, because I feel like it gives a real sense of control and it relaxes me as well. But I understand that if you don't have the time to do all the research and things like this, then it can be quite daunting. I think if you were to just trust, if you were to give it to your doctor, I mean, you'd need to have a specialized doctor, because doctors are so incredibly like overburdened at the moment already. Having them like analyze an entire genome, your entire genome for you, and then advise based on that, I think is at the moment not really possible.
Maybe it's like a whole new field of jobs that we'll see in the future. Yeah, this is your genome doctor.
Yeah, genome doctor. Maybe.
Your life advisor.
I think that would be pretty cool. But I don't think it's something that anyone should be afraid of, because I, like you've seen it already, I'm a hypocrite in the sense that I know what my risks are. I still, like, even though I'm trying to sleep more, I'm just more aware of these things. I'm more aware of the things that I need. And I think that's really helped me to make some really positive lifestyle changes. Mm. And I don't feel like it's affected my life in a negative way since I got the result, because instead of kind of being afraid of the unknown, I can be maybe a little bit afraid of the known, but I can also take a lot of comfort in knowing that there's always something that can be done if you know about it in advance, and even if it's just preparing yourself mentally, I think it's a very good thing.
Mm. Very quickly, have we had any New Year's resolutions, Iman?
We've had a few. Loads of them are about kind of healthy diets, kind of eating better, being more aware of that.
So I guess we've kind of answered quite a few of those already.
Meatless Monday is a thing that's in my kind of friend circle that I'm looking forward to trying, and I think you were talking about earlier. I'd also like to try some meditation. I kind of get a bit restless, and I like to try doing something about
that. Yeah, that's a really good one. Mine is also classic, like sleep more, but also to be better with my Twitter, which Iman will be glad to hear.
I need lessons.
And the answer to the brain teaser, for anyone who hasn't got it, which I'm sure is all of us, I didn't get it when I was finding out, Sherlock Holmes asked to make a line shorter, a pre-drawn line shorter without altering it, and he did it in seconds. He did it by drawing another line next to it that was longer, and thereby that line in definition was shorter. Thanks, Sherlock. And on that note, I just want to say thank you so much for coming today. It's been fascinating, and for sharing like all your stories as well.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
What are we playing out on?
So we're going to finish on the most epigenetic song I could find, which is Turn Me On by David Guetta and Nicki Minaj. Keep me coming. My body needs a hero. Come save me. Something tells me you know how to save me. I've been feeling real low. Oh, I need you to come and rescue me.
For more Science Mixtape, you can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider. Or join us live every Saturday at 10 a.m. on Soho Radio, recently voted the best online radio station in the world.